Hello, this is the beginning of the second tape, and this is Angus MacLeod meeting with once again, addressing Chrissy MacLean from Orange. Now, Chrissy, I think I noted down some headings here, and of course, you're not meant to take them, you're just meant to look at them and see which among them you wish to take. We have already noted 10 headings on the first tape, and I will go over them all again. So we started with number 1, the early history of Lochs, 2, place names, 3, taxmen and run Rignan tenure, 4, land ownership, 5, crofting land tenure, and 6, Kelpie. We made some remarks on the first 6. And then there's fishing, including lists of boats, religion, Kelly House, and social changes in the 20th century. Now that is the first 10. I noted these additional ones taking us up to nearly 30. Well, education, of course, obviously you have to probably look at it. Schools, the post office mail service, telegrams, telephones. I put them down the way they come into my head. They're not in any sequence. Bardock or poetry, nicknames. Nicknames are very interesting. Local nicknames. Then local stories, surely local stories in your area. Roads, well, you must remember there was a time when there was no roads, but perhaps local folk will remember when the roads were laid down first. They certainly aren't all that long. Then the Leverhulme period of the 1920s and the land raiding of the 1920s. Perhaps you may wish to refer to the land raiding earlier on, particularly Southern Path. Of course, I have some material on these. Then the Gaelic names of plants. Maybe some old folk there that are expert in that field. But if not, it's not an essential one. Old medicines again. Again, you might have some old folk in your area that, but be that as it may, we come from old medicines to the medical services as they have. We have them now. And I could give you some assistance there with the original doctors in Louis, etc., and the original doctors in Lochs, etc. Then the domestic water supply. Well, I'm sure you remember yourself when I got that. The radio. Your father certainly remembers a time when there was no radio. Television. Electric supply. Then, of course, there is the Harris Tweed, and perhaps you would want to see a bit on the Harris Tweed. A lot of scope there. Wool from a crofter's sheep, the wool being dyed and carded in the home, and indeed a time when there was no mills. And locals, well, you'll find local old ladies not very happy to talk to you about locals. Weaving, well, plenty of weavers still around. Then there's the working of the croft, as it was done earlier on. There's a lot of scope there. There's emigration again, and the reason for it. And of course that brings us to work. You see, crofting cannot be sustained without work. Some form of work, because crofting is a part-time job. So there you are now, I brought your list up to 30. And I'll send you this paper I have in my hand for the first 30. And I'm sure there are plenty of others. So, Chrissy, I think what you will have to be thinking about is not a thesis at all, but a book. Perhaps you didn't think there was so much to be written about and to be noted in locally, even in your own local village. Lots of history. And it's being lost, and we rely on young, smart students like yourself. Now, I also looked at the transactions of the Gaelic Society of Inverness, these books, which I mentioned in the first tape, and I made a list. I have it here in a paper. I had a telephone call from your father just now, so he's coming in tomorrow, and I'll give him my first tape and this list, etc. Tomorrow. He may send it to you to Glasgow. Thinking of it, if you have time, you may look at the library, university library, Glasgow library, etc. More to come later. Hello, Chrissy. This is day two, and the next item on your list is fishing. There's a lot to be said about fishing, and I'm sure you'll pick up a lot of that local. We'll make a few notes here anyhow to get you started. In the very earlier period, the Hebrideans fished for their own domestic requirements. Commercial fishing only came later. And they fished with very small boats, and they fished with homemade nets, and the fish was very plentiful in all the lochs, and they didn't have to go out to deep sea much. They could get plenty of fish in the lochs. Another ancient way of catching fish was fish ponds. That is an enclosure they made when the tide was out. And when the sea went out again, you see, it left fishes trapped in that fish pond. No doubt, there may well be some on your foreshore. They are to be seen yet in the foreshore in various places. You could ask locally and just say a word or two about it. You don't need to go very deeply into that. It's all gone now. The other point, I suppose, that is to be made concerning fishing is that the inhabitants of the Scottish Islands practiced both fishing and agriculture from a very early date. There was an abundance of herring and whitefish to be found along the shore. And crofting and fishing go together. Crofting is a part-time work, and it needs some other form of work, and fishing was the traditional work that went along with crofting, and herring fishing in particular. So the herring fishing is a long story, and we'll make a point. Of course, they fished shellfish as well. I may say that edible fish, broadly speaking, that is, apart from shellfish, edible fish, broadly speaking, is divided into two main groups, pelagic and demersal. And each group requires entirely different methods of fishing. Pelagic fish are those fish which swim near the surface of the sea, such as herring and mackerel, etc. And the traditional method of fishing for these fish used to be gill nets, whereby the fish was caught by the gills in the meshes of the nets. The second main group of fish usually referred to as demersal, D-E-M-E-R-S-A-L, are found in the lower depths of the and on the seabed. The traditional method of catching demersal fish was by baited hooks or trawl nets dragged along the bottom of the sea. So that's just a note for the beginning, I suppose. The fishing story, of course, is a long, long story, and I don't know how much you want to take in, but it was the Dutch and the Continentals that exploited the fishing around the coast of Scotland to begin with. And the kings and the crown of Scotland encouraged them and didn't encourage the local people much. In 1594, the Dutch fishermen appeared on the Louis coast for the first time. 1594. They were armed with a license granted by King James VI of Scotland. And then the crown had various schemes to exploit the Minch fishery by using Louis as a centre for the operations, such as the ill-fated five adventurers of 1598, etc. For the benefit of the crown, of course, not for the benefit of the local people. In 1678, there were 3,000 Dutch fishing vessels carrying some 50,000 men plying their trade in British waters. Their fishing fleet carried their own curers, and they cured their catch on board their vessels using their famous Dutch cure invented by a Dutchman to the brothels. Now, the Dutch cure was well ahead of anything that existed at the time, and because of that, they coloured the European market. And their method, of course, was to have a large, big fleet with supply vessels they remained at sea for months at a time, and they were serviced by fast supply vessels, which in turn rushed the cured herring to the continental markets, where the excellence of the cure enabled them to control the whole of the European market for salt herring. In that way, the Dutch became a rich nation. Now, government policy here wasn't designed to encourage the craft of fishermen during the 17th and 18th centuries, by reason of the way they administered the fishing. And they themselves went on to the Dutch method of large fishing buses, they call it the USSBS, they call them. And I don't think that was very successful. Whereas Crofter fishermen fished with smaller boats. One thing that is to the credit of the Seaforth, Colin Mackenzie, proprietor, he in 1623 made an effort to encourage the local fishing in the 17th century by inviting several Dutch fishing families to settle in Stornoway, and they settled there about 1623. In order to teach the local people modern methods of fishing as well as curing. These Dutch families remained in Louis for about 30 years, and because of that, the people of Louis came to excel their neighbours in the fishing trade in time. And they secured a good livelihood by combining fishing for both whitefish and herring with agriculture. So that at least is to present the credit of the Seaforth proprietor. Another thing that inhibited the fishing trade in the early period was the tax on salt. And salt was only available through a customer. And it was not until 1765 that a custom house was established at Stornoway. I don't seem to have a note of when the salt tax was removed, but I have it somewhere. I don't seem to have a note of it here. We will find that in due course. Actually, it was not until the beginning of the 19th century that the long years of neglect and mismanagement of the British fishery was at last coming to an end. The new century ushered in a period of growth. That was the 19th century. It was then that the herring fishing industry in Scotland caught on, following the activities of a number of far-sighted prominent people and societies, culminating in the incorporation of the British Fisheries Society, which greatly helped to lay the foundation of a very successful Scottish herring fishing. By challenging the Dutch in the European market and elsewhere, and by developing fishing ports on the west and north coasts of Scotland, the British Fisheries Society was incorporated in 1786. They began to develop Tobermory as a fishing port in 1787, and Ullaville in 1788, and they also surveyed a large number of other prospective fishing stations on the west coast and in the islands, as well as round the north and north-east coast of Scotland. After a few years, the society decided to concentrate their attention on developing Wick Harbour, which was completely undeveloped at that time, and the fishing boats in Wick operated from suitable rock frizzes and beaches. In 1801, Thomas Telford prepared plans for harbour facilities at Wick to accommodate 400 vessels on the southern bank of Wick River, in a new fishing village, where only half a dozen crofters lived in until then. The new fishing village was to be called Pulteney Town, Pulteneywtown, in honour of a former chairman of the British Fisheries Society. The building of Pulteney Harbour gave a tremendous impetus to the Scottish herring fishing, and most of the increased catch went for export. Shortly after the completion of Wick Harbour, an event of even greater significance took place in the discovery of a new way to cure salt herring that enabled the Scottish fishing industry to compete successfully with the Dutch, and eventually the lion's share of the European market was captured within a short space of time because of the excellence of the quality of the Scottish herring. The discovery of the new Scotch cure, as it was called, Scotch cure, by J. F. Donovan, D-O-N-O-V-A-N, of Leith, in 1819, quickly set a standard that was adopted by the fishery board. Before 1819, herring was lightly salted at sea when caught, and afterwards they were packed in barrels with an additional quantity of salt after the discovery of the Scotch cure, gutting before curing was adopted as a general practice, and eventually curers would not on any account touch any herring that was in contact with salt before being landed, because salt softens the fish and it does not cure so well after that. Earlier on, gutting was done by the finger, but soon it was necessary to adopt a special knife called kutak. So, Chrissy, perhaps you could talk to the girls about that and feel a little bit more. Louis' fishermen were ill-equipped to take advantage of the upturn in the Scottish herring fishing industry because their boats were small and their fishing gear was poor. The hemp nets in use at that time were made in the homes. In the first statistical account in the 1790s, Reverend Hugh Monroe, the parish minister of Oud Louis, stated that there were 275 net makers in his parish. In the second statistical account in 1833, Reverend Alexander MacLeod, the parish minister of Oud Louis, stated that, in a quote, "It is a well-known fact that of late there were an abundance of herring in the whole coast here, but most of the inhabitants had no nets that could fish so far out from the shore." Apparently the people of Oud and presumably the people of the rest of Louis were unable to benefit from the rich harvest of herring that lay off their shore. They were, however, able to take advantage of the shoals of herring that came into the sea lofts from time to time, as Reverend Hugh Monroe of Oud again states in the first statistical account in the 1790s, when he commented on the herring fishing in Loch Roag as follows, and I quote, "Great quantities of herring, often commonly large size, have begun to be caught in this loch within the last few years. This year, upwards of 90 sail came from different parts of the kingdom. They both fished and bought the herring fresh from the country people at the great price of from 9 to 12 shillings. That is 45 to 60 p per crane. I take it that's a crane, which is the full of a barrel of green fish. Green in this case means unsalted. During the 18th century and even the beginning of the 19th century, fishing boats in Louis were small as a rule, only about 16 to 20 feet long, with a single mast and sail and oar, and manned by a crew of 3 or 4 men with 8 or 12 hemp homemade nets. These boats cost 15 to 20 pounds each, as well as the cost of the fishing gear. Now, that was in the early part of the century. Coming up to the middle of the 19th century, the fishing boats were about 20 to 30 feet long, but completely open, undecked. Nevertheless, boats from Louis were among the early boats that were attracted to the Caithness fishing. Of course, you see, the Caithness fishing was based on wick, to which we referred earlier. But the Louis boats got there pretty early in the 19th century. They called it Ilscock Gallow. Gallow is a Gallow, but it's Caithness. It was reported that there were three Louis fishing boats among the 10 boats that were lost in a game at Wick in 1818, with the loss of 13 lives. So you see, Louis fishing boats apparently went to business fishing quite early. And certainly, from 1830 onwards, Louis' boats went regularly to the business fishing, as well as hired hands. Now you see, that is a feature of the fishing that you will have to touch on. Hired hands, as people that didn't have neither nets nor boat, they just went to work on the boats. And hired hands and fisher girls, well, that's two features of the fishing that you will touch on, and local people will surely be able to tell you quite a lot about these things, hired hands and fisher girls. Fisher girls went in crews of three girls, two girls and a packer. And they went to the summer fishing all around the Scottish coast, and then to the winter fishing to East Anglia. And some of them went to the Isle of Man and to Ireland at times. And that practice continued for over 100 years, until the beginning of the Second World War, but on a gradually decreasing scale after the First World War. So that practice peaked at as the herring fishing and everything else connected to the fishing peaked before the First World War. Because the European export market for British herring never fully recovered after the First World War. Towards the end of the 19th century, it was said that Wick had the largest Gaelic congregation in the world in season. A minister came with the Gaelic contingent from the north and the west, and the congregation gathered in their thousands on the banks of the Wick River to hear them preach. Now, the next big breakthrough in the fishing industry was in 1850. When James Patterson of Musselburgh invented a loom that was capable of weaving cotton gill nets. The nets were less bulky, these nets were less bulky than the old homemade hemp nets. And the boats could of course carry more of them, and the catching power was greater because the nets were finer. These nets continued in use until after the Second World War, when nylon nets came on the market. By about 1850, larger boats, up to 50 feet long, were coming into use. Some of them were half-decked, and a few fully decked. That was about 1850. Now, the type of boat they had at that time was Scaffy, C-A-F-F-I-E, and five boats, or design of boats. These are the two kinds that was popular with the Scottish fishermen, and the value of the half deck was soon appreciated because of the limited shelter, or degree of shelter it afforded. Fishermen referred to that shelter as the den. In Gaelic, enene, D-E-N-N-E, or den, it was den, a host in the column of Gaelic, and it's more often called. It was about this time that the designation Baldies, which is still in use for the new style decked fishing vessels, came into use. And the name Baldi came into currency or after the patriot, the Italian patriot Garibaldi, was fighting in the Italian Wars of Independence at that time, about 1850. That designation is still applied to middle-sized fishing vessels. Again, you could talk to your local people about that and see what they have to say about it. Now, on 18th August 1848, a large number of fishermen and 41 boats were tragically lost at sea in a gale on the east coast of Scotland. Following that tragedy, the government set up a board of inquiry under the chairmanship of Captain John Washington, R.N. They called it the Washington Board, and the report was published in 1849. One of the most important recommendations contained in that report was that more decked vessels should be built. Of course, like most innovations, the idea of a fully decked fishing boat was at first received with some skepticism by many fishermen who felt that such boats would be clumsy and unworkable. Well, there you are. It's the same with all things, isn't it? Fishing boats were being developed and improved during the whole of the 19th century. The whole of the 19th century in Scotland. And experiments were taking place during the second half of the century to find the most suitable fishing boat for the conditions that existed on the north and west coast of Scotland. In the 1870s and 1880s, the herring shoals moved further out from the shores, and there was a need for larger boats. Eventually, a new design based on the fore part of the 5-foot design and the after part of the scaffy design was adopted, and the first of the new design fishing boat was launched from Ashers, A-S-H-E-R-S, Ashers Boatyard in Birkhead, B-U-R-G-H-E-A-D, on 7th December 1879. The new boat was called Nonsuch, N-O-N-S-U-C-H, probably because it was nothing like it before. It was launched at the time of the Zulu South African War and was therefore dubbed Zulu type of boat. The name Zulu, Z-U-L-U, remained with that type of boat to the present day. The overall length of these large Zulu boats were 70 to 80 feet long and the beam 20 to 22 feet. And they carried 70 or 80 or more nets. We could describe a net. A net is 36 yards long, and 70 or 80 or more nets in a straight line extended to about 2 miles long. So you see, that was from the Zulu time. The fishermen declared that the Zulu boat was the answer to the fisherman's prayer. Boats with a steam-driven capstan as an aid to hauling their nets. Boats that would come about almost within their own length, and they could storm out to the distant fishing grounds in boisterous wintry weather. They had two masts, and they carried a lot of canvas, which gave them steering way in the least puff of wind. The last of the working big Zulu fishing boats was the Monarch, M-U-I-R-N-E-H-E, skippered by Alistair MacLeod, Knock Point, Lewis. He himself was out with it in 1945. and thereafter it was laid up and was sold to a crofter in Ballalan Lofts to be broken up for fence posts. So that was the end of the. You can find photographs of these boats for you. There was many of the big Sulu class boats in Lewes, and some of them in Rarnish as well, and Crossbus. So we'll come to that and find photographs of them. But I want to come back now and tell you a small story. You see, I said that the Sulu design is based on the front part, or the fore is the correct fisherman's term, fore part, of the Fifey design. And the after part of the Scaffy design. Now, there's a story about that. I don't know if you want to use it. It's amusing anyhow. I'm probably fictitious, but I don't know whether there's any basis in it or not. It was said that the Sulu design boat originally came about because of a young couple that became married. And her father had a Fifey type of boat, and they decided to make a new boat. And as usual with young brides, or brides of any age, probably. An argument arose as to whether it should be of the Fifey or the Scaffy design. So they compromised, you see, by one having the fore part and the other having the after part. And it was said that that is how they were a wise couple. They compromised, and in so doing, they came across a good design. Now, I perhaps have jumped ahead, but what you will do is anything that is there of any use to you, you can make notes on a piece of paper and enter it into your thesis at the proper point. Since we are talking about Sulu fishing boats at the moment, would say that you should try and get as many names of the boats in your locality as possible. And incidentally, as an aside, I might tell you that the boat my father had at one time was called Tavarnish. I think it was Tavarnish, Lawrence or Crossbow. It was called the Carter Castle. I'm quite sure that the boat there. We had a number of boats, the big Sulu class boats in Calamus. I could give you the details of these some other time. We had the Line, the INE, and we had the Scepter, SCEPTRE, and we had the Carter Castle, and all these three of them in Calamus. And then the Sulu boats were smaller too. Now, I have noted building plans of the Sulu. And I have a model of the Sulu too. Take a photograph of that model. And I know there was a number of these boats over in your area. When I went to the fishing first, there was one there who was full of old men. They called it Bath and a Motto from Rarnish. I think they were all at least 80, if not more. Pratamata. I don't remember the name of it. And then you see these boats, as they were telling you locally, at one time they changed them to engines on them. So we can come into that later on. You see, if you have a broad picture of the thing in your mind first, you will be able to know what questions to ask. Well, they started putting engines on boats. They did in the early part, perhaps in the first decade of the 20th century, of the 20th century. But very few engines were on boats here in the 20s, in the 1920s. But towards the end of the 1920s and in the 1930s, they were converting all the sailboats onto engines. And we had a fleet of sailboats with engines on them in the early 30s, with the exception of a few steam drifters. And I think I'll make a note of the steam drifter now so that you know the context in which they came in. So about 20 years after the launch of the first Sulu, fishing boat, came the first successful appearance in Scotland of the steam drifter. You see, they were around before then, but they had trapped their nets going into the propellers. Nearly all the steam drifters for the fishing industry, for the herring fishing industry, were built between 1900 and 1914. By 1913, there were 900 steam drifters in Scotland. The transition from the age of the sail to mechanical power in fishing boats in Lewes came gradually over the 30 or 40 years of the first 30 or 40 years of the 20th century. The first marine engine was installed in fishing boats in Scotland about 1906 or 7, but it was into the 1920s before wholesale conversions of the Lewes sail fishing fleet took place. There were virtually no purpose-built motor fishing boats in Lewes before the Second World War. Well, that's a thing to be noted. Very few, if any, purpose-built before the Second World War. The whole fishing fleet consisted of aging, converted sailboat and steam drifters. Now, something is to be said about steam drifters. I don't think it should concern you very much, but they were very expensive to run. And that is why they were discarded. The peak year of the herring fishing in Scotland was 1907, when 2.5 million barrels of cured herring was processed. In 1901, a big Sulu sailboat, 80 feet overall, cost approximately £700, while a steam drifter cost upwards of £2,500. That was not all. Steam drifters were expensive to run. They burnt up to 20 tons of coal a week, whereas sailboats incurred no expenses while at sea. Steam drifters were comfortable and viable enough during the prosperous period before the First World War, but the loss of the continental herring markets and the inflated cost of coal, etc., after the First World War, sealed the fate of the steam drifter. Yet skipper Finlay Smith, 15 Grimore, and many other skippers operated steam drifters in the 1930s, and there were many that were still in Stornoway up to 1940. And up to the beginning of the Second World War. And if necessary, I think we could probably get names and details of that. And a number of people from North Lothian, such as Anne Lully and Colum Winanog, he was from Cremor, and various other people, Cloud, Ellen and Irene. All these people moved out to Stornoway and were skippers of fishing boats, and your local people would be able to fill you in with those things. And if not, I might have some details. There's so much detail there that you'll probably be only concerned with the outline of these facts. And as I said before, books could be written on all that. But I didn't see anything yet about the development of Stornoway as a fishing port, but I really do want to say something about that, because it's very important from the herring or all aspects of the fishing industry. The development of the herring fishing at Oman Lewis was far behind that of the herring fishing industry in Caithness. You see, the development of wheat in Caithness gave a big impetus to the fishing in Scotland as a whole, particularly to the fishing in the north of Scotland and the east coast. It was in the first quarter of the 19th century that the situation began to change in Lewis in a way that enabled the part-time trotter fishermen to participate more fully in commercial fishing. It was not until 1825 that the duty on salt, that the duty on salt was abolished. In 1830, the bounty system, well, that was a form of assistance by the government, and I don't think it's worth your while bothering about that. That was in relation to the buses, the big ships. The big boat fishing system. In any case, this is the beginning of part two of the second tea. And as I was saying, we were talking about the bounty system, which was a form of subsidy geared to the large fishing boats, and actually damaging to the small craft or fishermen. It was discontinued in 1830. I don't think you should bother much for that. In the 18th and 19th centuries, the Lewis estate factors, and this is an important point, I was looking for it before. In the 18th and 19th centuries, the Lewis estate factors and their taxmen established a commercial salted and dried cod and ling fishery based on small curing stations, Tehensali. So I think you'll find your old folk over there talking about Tassali here and there, salt hills. These were dotted all around the Lewis coast, particularly on the pebbly beaches, because that was very suitable for laying out the salt fish in order to dry in the sun and wind. The Culver's taxman was said to be one of the most progressive entrepreneurial fishermen. Taxman. Now his name was Robert Weir, and he had a salt house on the Pebbly Beach called Gore in Calvert. Of Well, we come back to the landowning system again, and that ensured that the croft or fishermen had no real freedom or independence, even as fishermen, but were in permanent bondage to the system. You see, the system that I refer to, the system of the Tern Sally and the whitefish they handled, was through the estate down there. Very often through the estate, anyhow, probably all of it, and the tax. Well, the crofter fishermen were short of capital, anyhow. Where were they going to get money to buy boats and gear to enable them to buy boats? The fishing gear, of their own. And they were therefore dependent on the taxmen or the estate factor to provide boats and fishing gear or advance cash to the. This is the way I'm saying they were in bondage to advance cash to the fishermen against the security of their fishing catch. In that way, the fishermen were under obligation to fish exclusively for the taxmen, on pain of instant dismissal from their holdings. They were also obliged to sell that catch to the factor or taxman, even if the boat and fishing gear was their own, and in the absence of healthy competition, the price received by the fishermen was very low as a whole. The second statistical account written by the parish ministers in 1833 gave an interesting account of the state of the fisheries in the four parishes of Loughs at that time. Reverend John Cameron, minister of Stornoway Parish, says, "The fishing of cod," and I quote, "the fishing of cod, ling, and herring is the principal employment of the male population. The seasons are divided between fishing, farming, and kelping, and most families have a share in a fishing boat, as well as a lot of land, that's a croft. Herring has not been so abundant for several years. They are on the coast, but the people are here not acquainted with deep sea fishing, and their boats and nets are not fit for offshore fishing. The number of vessels belonging to the port is 67, and the number of boats in the district," that were the whole of Lewis, I'm sure, "of the port, in the district of the port, is 1,500. Now that is very significant, what he says about the nets and fishing there. Even as late as 1833, whereas some of them by that time were big enough to go to the Caithness fishing. So you see, you have to balance these various sources. It is obvious from the remarks of the Lewis Parish ministers in the early 1830s that the inhabitants of Lewis participated in fishing for both herring and whitefish extensively, but their boats and nets were not very suitable. Well, we have already made the point that the machine-made nets didn't come until 1815. The key to the proper development of fishing in the Hebrides were larger boats and better fishing gear, and above all, better harbour facilities and quays as well as marketing. So you see, keys at this time were completely absent. I didn't come to Stornoway yet. Keys in the rural areas were completely absent. Well, that's our administration. Colin Dillon gave us a few keys because we administer ourselves. Until then, we got precious few of keys or anything else. Now I come to Stornoway. stored away as a fishing boat was undeveloped at the time, while Wick was forging ahead as a prosperous fishing port. When Martin visited Stornoway, circa 1700, he tells us there were only 60 families there at the time. So Stornoway was just a village, like Cornish, when Martin came. Some 80 years later, when John Knox visited Stornoway in 1786, he commented that they were sorry to see that noble port without a quay. Without a quay. These vessels, he said, had to load or unload upon the beach or in the bay by means of small boats. The situation in Stornoway had not improved much when the Stornoway Pier and Harbour Commission was incorporated in 1865. And way back in 1865, some 64 years after Thomas Talbot prepared plans for harbour facilities at Wick in 1801. So you see the way we were lagging behind. In fact, the need for quays all over Lewis was belatedly recognised 40 years earlier in 1824, when a list of places in need of quays were drawn up. As usual, however, action was slow, and it was between 1828 and 1835 before small piers were built at Ness and Carrinaginuig. Talbot was on the list, but it never got a quay. Portnicuran, which was first surveyed about that time, did not get a quay until 100 years later. Talbot didn't get it at all. And Brevik has only got it this year. And perhaps it's no much use. In any case, the fishermen are gone. Fishermen are gone from everywhere. The herring has gone from everywhere without any quays. However, we'll come back to Stornoway. Once the Stornoway Pier and Harbour Commission was incorporated in 1865, and incidentally, may I mention here that Sir James Matheson, who was the proprietor of Lewis at that time, did his level best to take over the whole of the Stornoway coastline from Arnish Light right round to Sandwich, so that he would be proprietor of that. But there were a number of people in Stornoway, and some of them were country people that went in there, fought him tooth and nail. He had a small quay there made for himself for the boat he had with the mails. However, we come back to 1865 and the Pier and Harbour Commission. Once they were they embarked on a comprehensive program of quays and foreshore developments, which continues to this day. So they developed Stornoway, and they are still developing it right now. Undoubtedly, it was the development of Stornoway Harbour and facilities that was the most important single factor in the development of the fishing industry in Lewis, because Stornoway then became the centre and focal point for most of the fishing activity in the whole island, and the growth of the herring fishing industry in Lewis in the second half of the 19th century was quite phenomenal. The whole of the Lewis community owe a debt of gratitude to the Stornoway Harbour Commissioners for their foresight down through the years. Now, you could illustrate that with photographs, old photographs. No time was lost by the newly constituted Harbour Commission to prepare harbour order plans, and I have a note on these facilities. I just mentioned the first few. A harbour order to authorise them to execute the following works. 1. a timber wharf 150 feet in length, which was the original part of what became known later as Number 1 Wharf. 2. A quay wall of masonry 350 feet in length, seaward of high water, a high water mark, extending northwards from the said timber wharf to the quay known then as the Old Quay. Well, the Old Quay was something that the proprietor had there. That masonry quay occupied the position of the wreck of the bark Amity. So, you see, Amity was the wreck of a bark that was used for quay. It was opposite the harbour office as it is now, or the custom house as it was before then. And they call that quay in Amity, or Esplanade Quay, even to this day, that part of the quay. And then the third thing is the reclamation and infilling of a space behind quay in Amity made that area on the Esplanade available for fish curing or other purposes. 4. The provision of works, buildings, sheds and warehouses, etc., which may from time to time be necessary for the improvement of the harbour or the accommodation of the shipping. So you see, that was four points in the first programme of development, and there was quite a number of programmes down through the years. These were necessary improvements provided by for the expansion of the fishing industry in the 1860s, 70s. By 1881, it was clear that the expansion of the fishing industry was outpacing, that's the expansion of the fishing industry was outpacing the harbour improvements, and consequently more and more harbour improvements followed. The harbour was further extended in 1881, 1892, 1930-34, and 1947. The wheat fishery had reached its peak of development in 1863. So that's an interesting point. The wheat fishery had reached the peak of development by the time the Lewis people and the Stornoway people pulled their socks up and started to develop their key facilities. We're only beginning to develop them in 1865, 2 years after the peak year in Wick. In the 1850s, the landings at Stornoway was only about one-fifth of that of Wick. In the early 1850s, there were 1,200 visitor workers at Wick, of which nearly 5,000. I think I'll read that again. In the early 1850s, there were 12,000 visitor workers at Wick, of which nearly 5,000 were from the Highlands and Islands. So you see, Wick provided work for a lot of people. As Calvinicum used to say, "Is what Wick a good parish?" "Oh, the other week," he would say. As the herring fishing developed in Lewis, the fishermen acquired larger boats. The fishermen in the landward areas of Stornoway Parish were able to berth their boats at Stornoway. Not the fishermen are back and point in these places for the weekends. Bertha Matrona for the weekends, and during the off-season, after the harbour was developed, of course. In the sheltered anchorages of locks, however, the local fishermen put down permanent mooring facilities, and we recall seeing every anchorage in locks, both north and south, packed full with moored offshore fishing boats in the first half of the 20th century. So there you are now. You can get on to your Dhokar people and get them to tell you more about that, more about the things that saw themselves anyhow. I have a nice photograph of Cremor with 7 boats moored there in 1930, I think it was, 1932. So we'll see what we can WhatsApp for illustrations for your article. The point that should be made in connection with all that is that the growth in the population, which we mentioned before in the 20th, in the 19th century rather, from about 9,000 to 29,000. Well, what would that population have done without the herring fishing? Without potatoes and salt herring? So we were mainly living on porridge in the morning and potatoes and herring, perhaps twice a day, and fresh fish and salt fish and all that, and that was a very healthy diet as well. However, you could mention the value of the fishing. Herring is the best thing. Of course, that is recognized now by the factory that Soren Collins has referred to the oil and all the things. I get out of herring over there, and out of fish. We had a good keeling out in Calipas, Tainish and Baroque. His wife was from Rarnish. Ishpal. Ishpal Varoki, Ishpal Varoki. I'll get it in a minute. A nice lady she was, and her sister Madinak as well. Ishpal Varoki Wood. That's what they called her. Madinak Wood. Oh, he told us all about the fishing. Sapashur Week. Well, if you want details of Sapashur Week, we'll give you that. 1852. When the islanders and the Caithness people spent a whole week fighting. It was a gale on, so they stayed ashore and they fought all week. They started the fight over an apple, and it was a boy from Loth that was concerned, and a boy from Loth and a boy from Caithness, and started fighting over an apple. And that a whole big fact about that. But these are, I suppose, details that you want to have space for. And of course, you see, there is a great deal to be said for yen boar and yen pig and white fishing, and surely your local folk will give you a lot of that. And if not, we'll go into that. Into that, you see. And then you could ask your local folk about painting the boats every spring before the season, and preserving the nets that's cast out. The nets were backed, cast every so often, every month or so. And the quote here, fishermen barked and dried their cotton nets regularly in order to preserve them. They were barked by immersion in a hot solution of water-soluble resin called kutch, C-U-T-C-H. Kutch was obtained from the bark of the mangrove trees in Borneo or the acacia trees in India, the bark was stripped off the tree and boiled in water until it attained a syrupy consistence. Then it was poured into molds and exposed to the sun until it was hardened into marketable briquettes or blocks, which came to Scotland in hardwood boxes, 100-weight boxes, Buchish Hurstel. And your old folk in Ranish will remember Buchish Hurstel quite well. The superior brand favoured by the local fishermen was marketed as Pecu Catechu, P-E-G-U hyphen, C-A-T-U-C-H-U. Now there's all sorts of things aside like that you can fill in. Incidentally, you would get the names of the boats in earlier years in the custom house, in the fishery office in Stornoway, in the fishery office. You could send your father over there and the boys there will give him books. They go a book per year. You just turn the leaves over and mark any lost boats that he's interested in. And I would myself be very interested in that. I have some of the South Lost ones, which of course you may have. Now, we refer to painting the boats. The nets were mended in the home in the winter, and the boats were painted and tidied up at the beginning of the summer, and I think perhaps the last one that was in Rorish was Agnes, wasn't it? John McLeod's boat. However, you'll find that all information locally. The last gill net, herring fishing boat in Lewes, was in Marwick. And the Seafarer, SY210, skipper Duncan MacLennan Marwick and his brother, they have the distinction of being the last Lewes boat to be engaged continuously in commercial herring fishing by the traditional gill net method of thrift nets, until they were forced ashore by the total ban on any form of herring fishing in 1977. Now, when we talk about gill nets and thrift nets particularly, you will have to remember that young people like yourself nowadays will know what thrift nets are. I have made an illustration of thrift nets here, and you may borrow that as well. Thrift nets get their name from the manner in which they are worked. From 30 to 80 nets are tied end to end and laid out carefully in the hold of the fishing vessel, depending on the size of the boat, ready to be cast or shot, that's what the fishermen call it, over the starboard side of the boat as it steams slowly on its way, until there is a curtain or wall of netting some 18 yards deep and perhaps as much as 2 miles long, suspended from floats or buoys some 10 to 20 feet below the surface, and depending on the size of the buoy, the The boat itself rides at the end of the fleet of nets to which it is attached by means of the spring rope. The spring rope is a rope under the nets that weighs them down. Both boat and nets drift quietly with the tide, hence the term drifting, drifter, or drift nets. See? Each net is about 36 yards long, 18 yards deep, and the size of the mesh is about 1 inch by 1 inch square. And as the fish swim against this vertical wall of netting, they become enmeshed in the gills, hence the term gill net. Of course, the drift net can only be used for fish that swim fairly near the surface of the sea, usually referred to as the pelagic fish, such as herring and mackerel. With this method of fishing, the fish has a sporting chance of avoiding the net, and it might therefore be regarded as a more environmentally friendly. So that will give you points if you get that word into your thing. As it tends to conserve the stock of fish. Modern thinking, however, regarded as inefficient. So you see, the environmentalists are not included in that. After a few hours of rest, the crew turn out, that's after they've shot the nets, after they turn in for a few hours of rest, and they turn out to haul their nets. So a description of that sort of thing would be quite useful. And then the silvery, glistening sheet of silvery herring are shaken out of the nets and slide down through the manholes in the deck into the lockers or a fish hole. So you can see that some old hobby in Rotten has told you that. If it's a good catch of herring, the crew is light-hearted, and that makes the work light. If, however, the haul is black means without any herring, the crew is quiet and heavy and a sad countenance. And that's how it is. Be sure to get one or two local girls, herring girls, pictures of herring girls. There's a nice picture of Stornoway, the whole lot of these Sulu sailboats ranged along the quay with their very tall masts. And then there's one of the lighthouse with them sailing past. I have a list of Calvus boats here starting with 1869, which I acquired in the fishery office. Rouse About, SY43. Magdalene, SY688. Mary Kennedy, etc., etc., etc. Fishing, of course, was a dangerous occupation, and you may well know of local people that was lost at the fishing, and that's quite interesting. I have Roddy Finlayson Calvust, 1877, was born in 1877, and he was a deckhand in an East Coast herring drifter and was lost overboard. And then Hector MacLeod, also a columnist, he was on the steam drifter Trident in 1909. The age of 22 years was swept overboard. People like that. So these smaller sites would liven up your article. Oh, most of this tape is on fishing, so I better change the subject now. I'll be boring you. Right now, Chrissy, I'm back on the job following day, and today's date is the last day, the leap year day, 29th February, 1996. And shall we say a few words on the mail service, the Royal Mail letters and that? Now, the earliest record we have of a postal service in Ross is that of Alan Ross, who was a Free Church school teacher at Crossapost. And he also acted as postmaster and Inspector of Poor. Now, before Alan Ross came to Crossapost, he was the teacher in the parish English school at Kells. I think that school was set up, if I remember right, in 1796, but we'll come to that later on. Alan Ross was born in Crippick in 1803. One of the Rosses of Crippick, they're a well-known family, and perhaps we'll refer to them later on. Now, there wasn't letters moving about after Alan Ross came down from Kells. I don't know whether Alan Ross was a postmaster in Kells or not, but I would think that probably he was. And I would think, just off of this as a guess from the top of my head, I would think that very few letters were in circulation at that time. The minister would be getting letters. Well, there was only one minister in the whole of Loch. The taxman might be getting a letter here and there. And it was very convenient to have Alan Ross as a postmaster for the whole of Loch. The people would be attending church, first of all at Kells and now at Crossapost. So he would give a letter for the Calvus taxman. He would give it to the elder in Calvus on Sunday and tell him to give that to... Probably that's how it worked, but I don't know. I can't think of Alan Ross going round the door. Now, anyhow, that was when when Alan Ross died in 1870. Now, it isn't all that long since 1870. That's only 130 years ago. His modest post office equipment, consisting of a small portable box, was passed on to his successor, who was Kenneth Mackenzie Cognoletti. His dates, he was born in 1837, died in 1899. He was a son of Donald Mackenzie of 19 Crossmouth, and Cognoletti, as you know, settled on 28 Crossbows. And the box Alan Ross passed on to him was the symbol of his authority as a sub-postmaster of Loch, the whole of Loch. Now, that was 1870, and the post office in Crossbows wasn't opened until July, 11th of July, 1874. So must have been a few years. Cognoletti had a few years with just the portable box and then a post office. Now, Cognoletti was married by this time. He was married to a formidable lady from Calvert. Where else? Ishbog Nicholson, great aunt of mine, daughter of Mother Nixon 11 Columbus. And by all accounts, she was called Bell, Ishbal Bell. By all accounts, Bell was a progressive lady. She undertook the collection and distribution of the mails in her extensive district. Now, she walked out with a creel on her back, that's what she used. She met the horse-drawn gig that carried the mails from Stornoway to Harry's, and she met them out at the doctor's house, Click and Ban, I think they call it, near the present doctor's house. And that was 3 or 4 miles from her home. On 3 days a week, she walked out there on 3 days a week with a creel on her back, for which she distributed the mails. Her allowance was 20p a week, which was raised to 25p a week after a while. In 1883, a South Loch's mail service for the summer months only, for the first 8 years, was commenced. That's the first mail service to South Loch, 1883, and it was commenced from Crossopost, across Loch Edisor to Cromore. From thence, Ishbal Mackenzie took the mails to a distributing box at Calvost. And from the Calvost distributing box, there was a large box, the mails were distributed through Gravan, Limerick, etc. Now the Calvost mail distributing box was still at Calvost in the early 1930s, and I remember it quite well. Well, what would be the size of it? It would be 3 feet high, 3 feet wide probably, and 4 or 5 feet long. So it's a large box. We as boys could crawl inside it. Now originally it was sited beside the Garrag Moor, but John MacLeod T. Calvus took it when he was a postman. And we remember it at the end of John MacLeod's house. So these are small details. The first sub post office in South Loch was opened at Graver on 4th December 1884 with a salary of £4 per year for the postmaster. Postmaster's name was Neil MacPhail, 19, Graver. Subsequently, the mail delivery to South Loch increased to 2 days a week, and later to 3 days a week. And indeed, when I remember first, it was 3 days a week. The postmaster in Calvost walked over to Cromore when I was in school, and probably after. Well, no, not after I left, but when I was in school. It was not until 1928. That the South Loch's mail delivery became a daily service. Now you see, 1828 is a significant date for South Loch's because it was in that year that the road round from Ballallan, from the end of the loch to Harvest, that it was in that year that it was completed. There was a bridge which wasn't done until for quite some time. So, when the road was completed in 1928, the mail car went on. Now, a sub post office was opened at Cromore in 1914. That was long before 1928. And the South Loch's mails were ferried across Loch Edisor from Crossbus Post Office and sorted at Cromore Post Office. The Calvost and Marwick mails were collected at Cromore by the Calvost Food Postman, which was John MacLeod, 3 Calvost, Ian and Hoyne. And then it went on to Alexander Mackenzie, called Gladdy, in 1918. And it was Gladdy that was Alexander Mackenzie's postman when I was here. that situation continued until 1928. And in 1928, a post office, a sub-post office was opened at Marwick, you see, and the fruit postman ceased to walk over to Cremorne. He always walked over to Cremorne until 1928. Now, further up at the end of the loch, a sub-post office was opened at Laxey on 8th December 1884, and the mails for half was Kerstelgirward and Carstry was ferried across Loch Eridan from Laxey to Kerstelgirward. In 1927, a sub-post office was opened at Kerstelgirward. 1927. So you see, these things are old. The older people are still alive. I remember some of these things. Insofar as South Loch was concerned, and I'm sure it's probably the same in North Loch. Anyhow, fruit postmen were discontinued altogether in 1950. You see, up to that point, although there was Royal Mail came, the fruit postmen distributed the mails. In 1950, in South Loch, and the mail delivery service was mechanized. And Norman Nicholson, 19 Lamery, was until then, a local postman for Limerick and Hornsey, was provided with an official Royal Mail van, and he set out in the morning to collect the mails in the various villages in Park and delivered them to the sorting office at Ballala. So, substantially, that is how the thing is to this day. Eventually, the post office in Cremorne closed, and the post office in Graver is the other changes in 1973. But you probably won't be going into the detail of that. It's the overall picture that you want concentrate on. And that is all I'm saying on the mail service. If you have questions, you might ask them to somebody else. Should have said that the post office opened in Stornoway in 1756. See? And that's the first post office in Louis. The post office in 1756. That's only 250 years ago. So, if you want to speculate what was going on before that, very few letters when you think of all the letters that are out today. Now, my next subject will be telegrams, and I think we're coming to the end of our tape. I will say that in February 1870, the state took over the electric telegraph service, which was run by several private companies up to that point. And then the state formally opened a public telegraph service. And it opened it from 2,488 offices, the majority of which was in railway stations. By 1872, the number of telegraph offices doubled to 5,000. So that is about 1870, the state took over from a few companies that were there. So I suppose we're at the end of our tape now. Not quite, so I'll give you another. At that time, the west of Scotland from Oban northwards was completely devoid of any telegraphic communications, but representations were being made from Stornoway as from other parts of the islands, particularly on behalf of the valuable herring fishing industry. And on 28 June 1872, the Cable lay boat SS La Plata, LA-PLATA, commenced to lay a cable across the winch from Storno to Rohu. It started at 1 o'clock, and by 6:30 p.m. the following message was transmitted across the winch to Donald Monroe Town, Chamberlain, Storno. Message reads as follows. I have much pleasure in informing you that the cable connecting the Western Hebrides with the mainland has been successfully completed today. Thank you very much, that's the first message.